Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, it's Xavier Greenwood here from Tortoise. This week on the Slow Newscast, the story of an amazing woman.
She just caught my eye, like she had this aura around her that caught my eye.
And the 15 minutes when dreams are made or broken.
Nobody knew anything about her or what to expect, and she just blew the competition away.
This is the story of Simone Biles, the best gymnast of all time. To listen to the greatest, just search for the Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 26th of June, these are our main stories. Kenya's president has accused criminals of hijacking huge protests against tax rises, during which parliament buildings were set on fire and five people were shot dead by police. The 14-year legal battle of Julian Assange is drawing to a close, with the WikiLeaks founder having arrived in court on a remote US island in the Pacific for a brief court hearing. A trial has started in Ecuador of five people charged with killing a presidential candidate last year. Also in this podcast,
the letter signed by Albert Einstein is a version of one sent to President Roosevelt, written in 1939.
The document, which warns about the danger of nuclear bombs, is up for sale. The Kenyan president, William Ruto, has described violence during huge protests against tax rises as an unprecedented attack on the country's democracy. Medics say at least five people were shot dead by police in Nairobi as protesters broke through cordons. Parts of the parliament complex and city hall were set alight. In a televised address, Mr. Ruto expressed determination to combat violence.
It is very painful for Kenya that a conversation this crucial was hijacked by dangerous people who have cost us the kind of loss we have incurred as a nation today. I assure the nation of the government's determination to fulfill its constitutional duty of protecting the people of Kenya against all forms of harm.
Our Africa correspondent Barbara Platt-Usher is in Nairobi and assesses the protests and the effect on the country.
Protesters have been flooding the streets of Nairobi and other major Kenyan towns, rejecting a new finance bill that increases taxes. There have been demonstrations for a week now. This was the biggest so far. It's an organic movement formed by young people on social media, and it's caught the government by surprise. Protesters like Christine Muhindi say this is about their future.
We want to make a better Kenya for even our children. We are trying to make an impact. Hope the government listens to us and does something. Even though they passed this bill, Kenyans have awakened. Even though people are tear gassed, we are still going.
But the tension increased as the day wore on. Police fired round after round of tear gas to stop the chanting youths from reaching parliament. Then it turned lethal. The police switched to live ammunition when protesters breached and entered the building, killing and injuring some. Members of parliament who had just voted to pass the tax bill were whisked away to safety. Part of the building caught fire. As evening fell, President William Ruto addressed the nation.
Today's events mark a critical turning point on how we respond to grave threats to our national security. I assure the nation that the government has mobilized all resources at the nation's disposal to ensure that a situation of this nature will not recur again at whatever cost. I have directed all the organs of our national security to deploy measures to thwart any attempt by dangerous criminals to undermine the security and stability of our country.
He said the protests had been hijacked by criminals, but he still wanted a dialogue with the young people who had raised pertinent issues. This is uncharted territory for the president. Kenya's powerful are facing an unprecedented challenge from the people.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Kenya. And while the police in Nairobi try to restore order there, a contingent of Kenyan police has arrived in Haiti. This is to lead a much-anticipated international force to tackle the gang violence there that has spiralled in recent months. Jacqueline Charles is the Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald, who says that despite the protests at home, the Kenyan police would stay on mission.
I do not see them turning back. In fact, President Biden just issued a statement expressing gratitude to Kenya and all the countries that are participating in this multinational security support mission and reiterating that this is very important for Haitians and for Haiti, and that Haitians deserve security like everyone else. These police officers from Kenya, they are part of an elite group. We've been told all along by the Kenyans that their participation is not going to affect their efforts for security in Kenya, but it is a dramatic situation that's unfolding right now. The Haitian National Police, despite their many challenges, they've managed to push back the gangs. But once a neighborhood has been lost to gangs, they can't really, you know, take it back or keep control of it. They need the help. But will 2,500 police officers, not just from Kenya, but from several other countries, will they be able to make a difference? I don't know. I mean, we've gone from where the debate was about we don't want intervention to we're desperate for any kind of help that we can. So there's been a lot of hope that's been put on this group, and we still don't know what the rules of engagement are. Are they going to be participating in operations? Are they going to be protecting just government infrastructures that have come under attack in the last couple of months? Or are they going to go out and help the Haitian police actually dismantle gangs? We're still waiting to see what those rules are going to be.
Jacqueline Charles, the Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. The founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, has arrived at court in the Northern Mariana Islands, a remote US territory in the Pacific, where he's expected to enter a plea deal that should result in him being set free. He arrived on the main island, Saipan, from Bangkok, having been released on bail from a British prison on Monday. Under the terms of the deal, he's appearing before a US judge and will accept a deal that will allow him to fly home to Australia. For the last 14 years, Julian Assange has been pursued by US prosecutors for leaking a vast amount of secret US military information. The Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, had lobbied the UK and US for his release.
Regardless of the views that people have about Mr. Assange's activities, the case has dragged on for too long. Yeah. There's nothing to be gained by his continued incarceration, and we want him brought home to Australia.
I heard more about the proceedings on the remote US territory from our correspondent Shaima Khalil, who is on the island of Saipan.
Well, I'm standing outside the US District Court here in Saipan, and this huge building, modern-looking building, is overlooking a beautiful beach, and it's lush green all around us, and it's hot and humid. And I cannot help but think what a contrast this is from what Julian Assange has just left in London, this prison cell in Belmarsh Prison, where he then boarded a plane to Bangkok and then landed here in Saipan. And we're expecting him to plead guilty for one felony, and that is illegally obtaining and disclosing national security material. No prison sentence, no prison time, because as part of the deal, he will be given credit for prison time spent in the UK. After that, Julian Assange will technically and officially be walking out of here a free man to head to Australia.
And as you say, it's quite a turnaround. He was in the highest security jail in the UK, and at one point it looked like he was going to face many, many charges and could be in jail, extradited to the US. It could be in jail for a very long time.
Remember, the original prosecution, they wanted to try him for 18 counts, mainly under the Espionage Act and mainly having to do with disclosing material or disclosing information, military information and diplomatic messages and making them public. And his lawyers have said that had he been convicted of those charges, I think he would have been facing more than 170 years in prison, essentially his whole life in prison. So quite a dramatic turnaround in this case with this deal that has been reached, and of which we don't know many details, actually. Even his wife was tight-lipped about the details of this deal. But it's also quite interesting, the location. The reason why this picturesque remote U.S. Pacific Island was chosen, because it is not mainland United States, because of this deep-seated mistrust that Julian Assange has of the United States, whom he had accused of trying to kill him in the past, which is something that Washington has denied. But he has refused to go to the United States. And this is why here in Saipan, in this Pacific beautiful island, is where the last chapter of this long and bitter standoff between the U.S. and Julian Assange will play out.
And briefly, he's facing a fairly hefty bill for his flight ticket.
$500,000. It is a very hefty bill. And from what I understand and what the reports that we've read is that they're going to find a way to try and pay it back. How, when, and how long they'll need to campaign or to find the money, no one knows. But yes, this flight across the world from London through to Bangkok, here in Saipan, all the way back to Australia, comes at a very, very hefty bill.
Shaima Khalil on the remote Pacific island of Saipan. The charges against Julian Assange have led some to brand him a criminal, while others argue he is a champion of the freedom of the press. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has been charting the wavering opinions of the WikiLeaks founder.
Julian Assange has long divided opinion. To his supporters, he's been unjustly prosecuted for revealing war crimes by Western forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. They say he has been persecuted for journalism and paid a heavy price. 12 years of confinement and detention, they say, has led to poor physical and mental health. Followers loyally demonstrated outside court hearings. Celebrities rallied to his cause. During his 7 years holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy, he was visited several times by the former Playboy model, Pamela Anderson. Vaughan Smith is a longtime supporter of Mr. Assange and the founder of the Frontline Club, a gathering space for journalists. He said Mr. Assange had been smeared and bullied by the state.
The law hasn't been applied to him, in my view, in the way that you or I would expect it to be applied to us. The legal process has been weaponized, and he's a political prisoner, and I think that's been quite a disappointing load.
But to Mr. Assange's many critics, he's an activist, not a journalist, a seeker more of publicity than the truth, a man whose criminal actions put the lives of servicemen and women at risk by leaking thousands of classified US military documents. While Mr. Assange hid in Ecuador's embassy, Chelsea Manning, the former US soldier who helped to obtain the documents, faced the courts and was jailed. Mr. Assange's detractors note that sympathetic allies and newspapers fell by the wayside as the years went on. They point to his links to the Kremlin-backed television network, RT, and how Ecuadorian diplomats lost patience with this intense, divisive figure. Alexander Downer, the former Australian foreign minister, said just because Mr. Assange was an Australian didn't mean he was a good bloke.
It's not appropriate to steal national security information and publish it. He released a huge amount of information, much of which was very embarrassing and some of which endangered lives. What he did was a criminal offence and it was a terrible thing to do morally as well.
And all this while Swedish prosecutors spent 7 years seeking to arrest Mr. Assange for two allegations of sexual assault, allegations which never came to court and which he always denied.
Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale. The trial has begun in Ecuador of five people accused of assassinating a presidential candidate nearly a year ago. Fernando Villavicencio was shot in Quito last August. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
The five suspects, all of them from Ecuador, were arrested at the scene and charged. Another man from neighbouring Colombia was killed by security guards. Many shots were fired and 12 people were injured at the rally. Mr. Villavicencio, a congressman and a former journalist, campaigned against corruption and organised crime. His killing highlighted Ecuador's failure to deal with the increasing power of criminal gangs. Over the past 5 years, they've turned a largely peaceful country into a major drug trafficking hub. It's not clear who ordered the assassination, but the Ecuadorian government at the time accused one of Mexico's powerful drug cartels of involvement.
Leonardo Rocha. A letter from the German-born theoretical physicist Albert Einstein, which encouraged the United States to develop the world's first nuclear bomb in response to the Nazis, is to go up for auction. It's being sold in the US alongside other artefacts relating to technology and innovation. They were collected by the late Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. It's expected the letter could fetch up to nearly $6 million. Our senior technology reporter Chris Vallance has more.
Over the course of his life, Paul Allen used his wealth to amass a diverse array of historically important artefacts. His interests, besides computing, included art, aviation, and popular culture. The letter, signed by Albert Einstein, is a version of one sent to President Roosevelt. Written in 1939, days before the outbreak of war in Europe, it highlighted the possibility of using uranium to develop nuclear weapons, and warned this was something Germany was researching. Mark Porter, chairman of Christie's Americas, told the BBC that the ensuing development of the Manhattan Project, and after that, the computing and the space age which came from it, was embodied in the letter. Other items to be sold at auction include a spacesuit belonging to US astronaut Ed White and a restored computer from 1971, of the type that Mr. Allen and Bill Gates first worked on prior to their founding Microsoft.
That report by Chris Vallance. Still to come.
The skin is very soft and stretchable, but the underlying robot face is very hard material.
Scientists in Japan have found a new way to attach modified human skin to complex humanoid robot surfaces.
Hi, it's Xavier Greenwood here from Tortoise. This week on the Slow Newscast, the story of an amazing woman.
She just caught my eye. Like, she had this aura around her that caught my eye.
And the 15 minutes when dreams are made or broken.
Nobody knew anything about her, what to expect, and she just blew the competition away.
This is the story of Simone Biles, the best gymnast of all time. To listen to the greatest, just search for the Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast. The BBC can reveal the UK government has written off or destroyed COVID-related personal protective equipment, or PPE, worth almost $1.8 billion. The stock was high quality and fully compliant with regulations. It's thought to be the most wasteful deal of the pandemic in the UK. Tim Frank spoke to our investigations reporter, John Ironmonger, who's been covering the story.
The company is Full Support Healthcare. It's got about 25 staff members. It supplies PPE to the NHS. It's been doing that for about 20 years. And it was set up by a former nurse, Sarah Stout, in 2001. And her husband, Richard Stout, became a director 2 years later. Now, before the COVID pandemic, the company had annual profits of £800,000. But all that was about to change because in late 2019, as people started getting nervous about signs of a virus spreading in China, Sarah Stout was spurred to action. She correctly predicted that demand would skyrocket and mobilised huge quantities of PPE from China, and then she just waited for the orders to roll in. In April 2020, the UK government ordered £1.8 billion worth of PPE, mostly gowns, aprons, face masks and goggles from Full Support. It was the biggest COVID PPE contract by some margin, and the stock was delivered by the summer. It was of good quality and it was perfectly usable. So it may come as a surprise that nearly all of the PPE provided by Sarah Stout's company will never be used in care settings. Around a half of it's already been destroyed. The other half is sitting in warehouses, pending disposal, at a further cost to the British taxpayer. And by our calculations, that's around £1.4 billion worth of PPE from one contract up in smoke.
OK, so £1.4 billion, which would convert here on the World Service to about £1.8 billion. Do we know why this stuff isn't being used? I mean, has it sort of just expired?
Yeah, there is an expiry, and the Stouts have told us as much. And because they sent it so soon in the pandemic, they were one of the first suppliers to actually deliver because of their background. They have suggested that this is the reason that perhaps it wasn't used. It is just sitting around now. We have put to the government why the PPE wasn't used on several occasions. They have said that our emails were missed and they can't provide a statement now because of the pre-election period. However, in a press conference, the UK Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins, said that the government was going to formally dispute the figure.
Are there any international comparisons? Have you been able to look into that?
From what I've looked into, I don't think we've seen in other countries comparable to the UK the same sudden dearth and then this subsequent rush to procure such colossal amounts as the UK did. There was a similar, perhaps, lack of preparedness for the COVID pandemic, if you like, in France, because in 2018, after inspecting their national stock, it was shown that their reserve contained expired masks and hundreds of millions were destroyed. But crucially in France, there's a difference because hospitals and doctors have the responsibility of storing their own PPE and not the government. Italy struggled too early on. There were reports about this with signs of depleting PPE. But as mentioned, they never got into the same dire straits as the UK.
BBC reporter John Ironmonger. As we heard in the earlier podcast, a Chinese spacecraft, Chang'e 6, which has gathered the first soil and rock samples from the far side of the moon, has returned to Earth. Scientists are eagerly awaiting to examine them in the hope that they will deepen our understanding of how the moon was formed and evolved. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker sent this report from Beijing.
The arrival of the Chang'e 6 was broadcast live to the nation. State media described the soil and rock samples as lunar treasures, while the craft slowly bobbed to Earth under a parachute and finally landed in a desert in Inner Mongolia. This is a clear source of Chinese pride and a major accomplishment, as John Perney Fisher from Manchester University explains.
This is the first time that we've got samples directly from the lunar far side, the bit of moon that we can't see up in the sky. So from a technical point of view, it's obviously quite complicated, and so it represents a good technical accomplishment, but also from a sort of a scientific point of view, the samples that are brought back are going to be quite unique.
Chang'e 6 blasted off in early May and a few weeks later landed on the moon's south pole when a mechanical arm and drill spent 2 days gathering samples. Chinese scientists believe these will include 2.5 million-year-old volcanic rock, which could tell them if there's a source of water on the moon. This mission is the culmination of decades of work. President Xi Jinping has poured huge resources into what he describes as China's space dream in an effort to catch up with both the United States and Russia.
Laura Bicker in China. So what does all this mean for space exploration or even a future base for mankind on the lunar surface? To explain all this, I spoke to our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
The near side and the far side of the moon are quite different. If you look at the near side, it's relatively smooth. We have these regions, these dark regions, which we call mare, which are sort of roughly translated seas. They're not seas of water. They're seas of rock, lava, but they're relatively smooth. If you go to the far side, it's very much more rugged. This is the great moon dichotomy. We need the rocks on the far side to understand the full history of the moon. Where does the moon come from? Why is it stuck in this position as it goes round Earth, where it only presents one side to us? We think it's because there was a collision early in the solar system between the Earth and a Mars-sized body. They came together. It left this lump of stuff in orbit around the moon, and that is what we see up in the sky today.
As you say, it's an extraordinary thing that they've done to go to the far side of the moon, go down, come back again with the samples. Presumably this is quite encouraging for future exploration.
Oh, absolutely. Just to underline how difficult it is to do what they've done, because it's on the far side, you can't do direct radio communication. You need a satellite in orbit around the moon to relay communications from your spacecraft on the surface up to lunar orbit and then back to the Earth. So it is very difficult. But think about the architecture of the Chang'e 6 mission, and indeed Chang'e 5, which was identical but only went to the near side. If you can put yourself down on the moon, do things, lift yourself back off, reconnect with an orbiting spacecraft, the thing that brought you to the moon in the first place, and then head home. What else can you do that? You don't have to do it with rocks. You can do it with people. And it's clear now that China is developing the technology to be able to put astronauts on the moon.
What, a lunar base in our lifetime?
Very definitely. They have talked about this, about having their own research station. There is really now a bit of a moon race
again, like we had back in the late 60s and early 70s with the Americans and the Soviets. The Americans are now determined to go back before the end of this decade, and China set itself the target of 2030 as well to get their astronauts on the surface of the moon. So it's going to be fascinating to see how that develops, and what you've observed with the Chang'e 6 mission is them developing the technology to do that.
Jonathan Amos. To football now. Austria have topped their group and reached the final 16 in the European Championships with a surprise 3-2 win over the Netherlands. Fans spilled out into the streets of Berlin to celebrate the win. But it wasn't such good news for everyone playing in the Euros on Tuesday evening, as our sports reporter Nigel Adderley told me.
Yes, I was unfortunate enough to be covering Denmark against Serbia this evening, a match which was played in Munich, and it finished as a 0-0 draw, and it was an awful game. But the point was very important for Denmark because it means they finish second behind England in Group C. Serbia had to win that game, but they failed to create anything really, despite having so many attacking players on the field by the end of the match. So they will go home early. But Slovenia also drew 0-0 with England in the other group, the other game in this group in Cologne this evening. And that's a real milestone for Slovenia because they will qualify for the round of 16 as one of the third place teams. England winning the group. But once again, it was a rather turgid performance from them, and one which will pose more questions than answers for their passionate football nation.
France, through, and Kylian Mbappe scored for the first time in his career in the Euros.
He did, but there was also a surprise in Group D. France were playing Poland, who have already been eliminated from the competition. And Mbappe did score his first goal in a European Championships from the penalty spot. But Robert Lewandowski, the veteran Pole, scored what could be his final goal at a major tournament, also with a penalty to equalise for Poland. And that allowed Austria to win the group because they won a dramatic match with the Netherlands in Berlin, 3-2. And everybody, it seemed, before the tournament was predicting that the French and the Dutch would dominate the group. But Austria have gone through as group winners. The French will go through as runners-up, and the Netherlands will also go through, like Slovenia, as one of the best third-place teams. And there is a possibility they could now meet England in the round of 16, which I'm sure would be a tie that neither nation would want at this stage.
So where does this leave us in the next stage of the Euros? Who are the favourites now?
Well, Germany, the host nation, started very strongly, but they had to ease through with a draw against Switzerland. They will meet Denmark in the round of 16. Spain have gone through with maximum points. They've looked very good so far. Portugal have the opportunity to also go through with three victories when they meet Georgia in their final game. But for a number of major nations like the French, the Dutch and the English, and also the Italians who went through in the closing seconds of their game against Croatia last night, they do appear to be sides at the moment who are yet to find their top form. And now it's knockout football. There really is no margin for error.
Nigel Adderley. Scientists in Japan have found a new way to attach modified human skin to complex humanoid robot surfaces. Julian Marshall spoke to Chris Dorsey, an associate professor at the Institute for Experiential Robotics at Northeastern University in Boston in the US. So what exactly did they do?
So you might want to put skin on a robot face to make it look realistic. The skin is very soft and stretchable, but the underlying robot face is very hard material. It makes it really hard to get a three-dimensional shape. So what they've done is make these anchors between the skin and the robot that mimic human skin. So it is very similar to the skin ligaments that go between the skin of our face and the muscles underneath. And this is quite exciting because their approach might make the skin more durable and long-lasting over time.
Is it live skin?
It is live skin cells, yes, mixed in with collagen.
And how long does it stay alive?
So that's not something they addressed directly in the paper, but what they did demonstrate was culturing the collagen in the skin cells over a week.
Is keeping the skin alive the main challenge at the moment?
I think that's a rather large challenge. So one of the things that the scientists in this work have not done is investigate blood vessels and lymphatic vessels that would help transport nutrients and oxygen to the skin cells and also transport them away.
Are there any particular advantages to using modified human skin rather than synthetic skin for humanoid robots?
Yes, there are a couple of advantages. So one is that skin has self-healing properties. So if we have a robot that's out in the world and it scrapes or cuts itself, it could heal rather than needing to apply new material. Another is that skin has touch sensors and temperature sensors already embedded within it and may also be able to do things like help the robot sweat to cool off, which means that the robot itself could do more work.
Is this something of a competition to see whether synthetic or real skin will win out, or are there different uses for each?
It's a bit of a competition between different research groups, for sure. But also, I see synthetic skin without any biological components, as well as engineered skin with skin cells in it, as having different purposes. Maybe we would want to use a self-healing material for a robot that will go out and do something for a few days, but we might want a robot that looks really realistic or that will last for a really long time to have the self-regeneration and self-healing properties of human skin.
Is this a procedure that's only applicable to humanoid robots, or could it have any use for humans as well?
One of the things in the paper that I thought was really interesting is they proposed to use the skin that they had engineered to understand wrinkle formation in humans. It could also have lots of potential uses for things like prosthetic devices, which would interface with your own skin.
Chris Dorsey from the Institute for Experiential Robotics at Northeastern University in Boston in the US.
And that's all from us for now. But there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, it's Xavier Greenwood here from Tortoise. This week on the Slow Newscast, the story of an amazing woman.
She just caught my eye, like she had this aura around her that caught my eye.
And the 15 minutes when dreams are made or broken.
Nobody knew anything about her, what to expect, and she just blew the competition away.
This is the story of Simone Biles, the best gymnast of all time. To listen to the greatest, just search for the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.